as coaching psychologists, I hope we are experts at behavioural change. You know, if anyone's going to get someone to change a mindset or change a behaviour, you know, it probably is us. We're very knowledgeable in both the skills of asking the right questions and all of that, but also the theory.
Welcome to Refreshing Leadership, the show where we give permission for you to be human first and foremost by bringing to life the incredible nervous system in action and the psychology of how we can move from surviving to thriving and even flourishing. Together, we go behind the scenes to this engine room of self-leadership, leading in your family, community, and organization by debunking old toxic approaches to leadership and instead demystifying it with practical and relatable conversations. I'm Kate Brassington, coaching psychologist, trauma-informed leadership coach, your guide and companion on this journey together. Hey everybody, welcome back to this episode of Refreshing Leadership. I've got who to me is a very interesting and exciting guest today, Dr. Natalie Lancer. Hello.
Hello.
Natalie is the chair of the Division of Coaching Psychology in the British Psychological Society, and she's a chartered coaching psychologist and a registered BPS supervisor, which is all huge, exciting, and credibility and gravitas and like all of that stuff. But that's not exactly why I invited you here, because secretly, you're also, or maybe not so secretly, we'll find out, you're also really into existentialism. That's your background. And have such a strong understanding of trauma. You and I have been on some things recently where, like, talking about coaching or coaching psychology or whatever, we were podcast and stuff. And I just thought to myself, wouldn't it be cool if Natalie came on the podcast? So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
What would you like people to know about you?
That is a very good question. Well, I think one of the things, I think that I'm a very pragmatic coaching psychologist and leader. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a slave to a particular doctrine or ideology or a way of doing things. Or, you know, you hear these buzzwords, you know, servant leadership, et cetera, et cetera. And I really dislike labels. And they can be useful, obviously, as a shortcut for saying things. But I don't think there's one way of doing things. Clearly, there isn't one way of doing things. So I definitely call myself existentially informed. I wouldn't necessarily say that to clients. I'm not sure everybody knows what that means. And indeed, what I think that means compared to another existentially informed coach is probably quite different as well. In fact, I know that's the case because I obviously do, as well as being a supervisor, I of course am supervised, as we all must be, as coaching psychologists. And I recently went to an existential type of supervision, which I would also say that I offer, but they couldn't have been more different, even within the existential realm. So I'm very aware that labels are pretty meaningless because they mean different things anyway to different people. And I also think it's important to say within existentialism that no one agrees anyway. So even the greats within existential thought, you know, famously Sartre said he wasn't an existentialist. And of course, he's probably the first person that springs to mind as an existentialist. So maybe it's like the first rule of Fight Club is that there are no rules. That's probably the first rule of existential psychology. And that suits me because I think I'm a bit of an anarchist at heart.
Oh my goodness, that is so cool. See, that's so interesting. And because I was wondering if that is really connected to your approach to coaching psychology. I'm not sure how much all the people listen to this from like many different backgrounds. Coaching psychology itself is new. And perhaps you want to just talk a little bit about what even is a coaching psychologist?
Yes. So all coaching psychologists will have a degree in psychology. And first and foremost, they are a psychologist. And in order to be called a psychologist, you'll have had to conduct some research in psychology. So you literally understand how to set up a study and how to analyze a study, but also importantly, how to interpret other people's studies. And that for me is the key thing, because people can write absolute codswallop, and to have the facility to say, I can call that out as nonsense, that's what marks a psychologist out. And also, I would say, to have the confidence to do that, to have the academic confidence to do that. So first of all, so we can be quite discerning in, you know, when we're learning a new technique, a lot of stuff out there in the coach training world is highly questionable and without evidence. But a coaching psychologist is able to say, able to go to the root paper, for example, root research, and to say, you know, this is credible, this is not credible, etc. Also to design new interventions and test their interventions, you know, not be afraid to, you know, play in the laboratory, as it were. How does one do that? You know, you don't do that willy-nilly. You have to get consent. You know, there's an ethical code. We subscribe to an ethical code. But at the same time, we can be quite creative in how we do that. We all have coaching skills, which you can acquire in from many types of courses. And we're bringing together our knowledge of, you know, behavioral psychology and lots of types of psychology. I mean, you said about we share our love for existential psychology, but there's loads and loads. And we bring that to bear in our coaching sessions. So I think that also does give us a certain amount of gravitas in that, you know, we're not sort of, we subscribe to an ethical code, which the BPS writes and is on their website. And we commit to coaching supervision. So we're taking our own practice and our own professional development seriously. These are all hallmarks of a profession, of a professional. Mm-hmm. And so we're not sort of doing a bit of coaching on the side. This is like properly our profession. That's not to say that coaching psychologists don't do other things. They might design leadership programs. They, you know, there's a whole host of other things. And of course, one can be, and this I think is where it gets super exciting. Most coaches are, in fact, sorry, correction, most coaching psychologists are, for example, an occupational psychologist and a coaching psychologist, or a clinical psychologist and a coaching psychologist. And I'm seeing more and more in my supervision practice that these people from other backgrounds, and you're an example of someone who had a different background who now uses that in their coaching. This is where I think we're at a frontier, because traditional coaching, maybe like non-psychology coaching, let's put it like that, was very clear about the boundaries between, say, therapy and coaching. There's lots of articles about this boundary. And one would understand that if you weren't a psychologist, one would have to tread very carefully. Mm-hmm. But if you are a psychologist, I probably argue you don't have to tread that carefully. You know, if you have a background in clinical psychology, why on earth wouldn't you bring that knowledge into the coaching session? It's the same you. You're one and the same person. Obviously, you'd explain to your client that you have this background and you'll be using all of it. But so there's been a lot of sort of fear around bringing one whole self into the coaching psychology role. But that's part of our expertise, is that we've come from different parts of psychology or, you know, and have real expertise in this. People have done doctorates in the most, you know, amazing psychological disciplines. And I'm always amazed how relevant it is to many, many coaching sessions. You know, you think it was something different. Mm-hmm. And it's not. And the reason it's not is because we're all human beings, which is where the existentialism comes in. The idea that that some piece of research you did on fire personnel, like firemen, firewomen, say about bullying, is not relevant to, I don't know, team leader in a corporate company who experienced bullying. That's just not true. Yes, the context is different and we do need to use our critical skills to discern what is relevant and what's not. But fundamentally, being bullied is something that happens in human experience, and largely our human experience is very similar, more than it is different.
Mm-hmm. So I love the, for me, what attracts me and what's different for me about coaching psychology is that it's so applied. And it's funny how, like, because you started off your, you know, your first answer to the first question saying, well, I'm very pragmatic. I'm not a slave to a thing. And I think that's a little part of me was kind of going, oh, yay, there is you. It's like it runs through you like a stick of rock. This is it's practical. It's so connected to whatever we call the real world, but like to real people's struggles rather than some academic or I'm not bashing the world of academia, because I think that it certainly I stand a lot on the work that they've done. But it's not applied. It's not listening to someone talking about their struggles in their life or those people who have been bullied, because that's grim. And that takes a certain kind of presence and place and space to hold for someone while they explore that and all of that good stuff. So when you're describing to me, and the thing why I keep being myself, being I'm like, why do I keep being drawn to, you know, British Psychological Society? That does, you know, why is it naturally a home of coaching? And how coaching has sort of evolved itself, as it were, to really stand on its own two feet in this place, and keeping its practical applied relevantness. Is that just, what do you?
Well, as you know, because you were on the podcast, I'm the host of the Coaching Psychology Pod, which is the division of Coaching Psychology's podcast. And so I interview lots of people, and we had an episode recently about neuroscience in coaching. And the bottom line is that a lot of people are saying that they are specialists or experts in neuroscience and apply this to coaching. And I've always been really suspect of that, because having done a PhD myself, I mean, I know neuroscientists who've done PhDs who would be scared to call themselves experts in neuroscience. So I'm always like, well, if they're scared to call themselves, and I always think that like the more knowledge you have, the more circumspect you are about calling yourself an expert at anything. So I'm not sure I could call myself an expert in existentialism, but you know, I have done a PhD in it, so I've certainly done a lot of reading in it anyway. That's what I could say. But I'm very, very worried about people who call themselves experts. And I think there's this sort of one could draw a graph. In fact, there is a graph. It's the Dunning-Kruger effect. Okay. So there's a concept. It's not actually, it's more of a concept than something that's been sort of proved, but the Dunning-Kruger effect. And it's essentially the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. If you actually do know something about, let's say, existentialism, you realize that there's, you know, thousands of works to read. Whereas if you read like the beginner's guide, you might be fooled into thinking, oh, I get that now. Mm-hmm. And I think the same is true with something like neuroscience or any of these specialties. So people saying they're expert in neuroscience, like, are you though? Like, are you really? And the what came out of the podcast was, no, they're not. So the truth is that where neuroscience has got to in its own research is so basic still that the things that some people are claiming that they're using from neuroscience and coaching, it just doesn't exist yet. So I know they don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they've read the papers, the journal papers, because otherwise they would know that as well. And, you know, it's things like, oh, I'm telling someone about fight or flight. That's neuroscience. Well, not really. And that's pretty much debunked anyway. So I think there's a lot of, even when people talk about left side of the brain, right side of the brain, this is also debunked. So what I'm extremely worried about is people thinking that they know things when really they don't, and that scares me.
Oh, I am so interested. Like, right there is this tension though between talking in academic language and knowing exactly as you describe it, like the more papers you read, the more papers you realize you haven't read, and talking in client language where someone can understand what you mean without having to swallow tons of papers for a reason of getting somewhere, getting something to happen, something to change in their life. I'm like very careful. Like, I don't call myself expert. It's difficult because other people call me expert and I have little areas of expertise for sure. And probably more than, you know, other people that I might hang out with on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, this thing about like right brain, left brain. When I was doing my training as a havening techniques practitioner, and we had to like pass this test in the brain, on the brain science, I still can't spell half the words, let alone remember them, let alone remember what happens in each area of the brain. And it was, we're looking at this huge map of the brain and just going, yeah, left and right is nonsense. Because it doesn't work like that. However, it kind of does. And if we're talking about, so when I'm talking to a coaching client, as was this morning, and they're giving me lots of logic and story and narrative, and I said, I wonder if that were left brain, and we're confident that that part of you knows all of those things, how might we move into right brain that is more sensing into the subconscious? Now, that I know that the brain doesn't have a big line down the middle of left and right, and it doesn't work like that. But it allowed them in the conversation to move away from the kind of stuckness that they'd got into of repeating it, and they had told me at the time before, and into this space where they were then curious about what was showing up. So I'm just kind of feeling a little bit back at you on that. Like, how do we navigate the language?
Well, I think it's important to be clear that we're using whatever we're saying as a metaphor, as a heuristic, you know, as an aid, rather than people thinking, you know, rather than us propagating some nonsense about how the brain works. But a lot of the nonsense people propagate is things that no one knows. You know, the neuroscientists don't know, so I don't know how some of these people know. So I think it's about knowing your boundaries and communicating. You know, as coaching psychologists, I hope we are experts at behavioral change. You know, if anyone's going to get someone to change a mindset or change a behavior, you know, it probably is us. And that's all well and good. I think the thing that's important, a coaching psychologist would, I think, A, be able to access some of the papers, you know, so if they do want to look at, want to Google what's the latest research on, I don't know, goal setting and gender, just as an example, then, you know, they would know where to find that and they could make sense of it. There's lots of models. I mean, coaching psychologists use models all the time to, I guess, in a piece around psychoeducation of their clients. So I think this is all very helpful for clients to be able to visualize and understand what their predicaments are. So that's the pragmatic part there. And I'm a big believer in, you know, if it works, do it. There's always a lag between the research that tells us why it works, but the practitioner knowing it does. And often it's, you know, in our discipline, you may well know something works and then go and investigate why. And it might take you 5 years to work out why, particularly, you know, by the time you've got ethical approval and you've written it up and you've done all the literature searches and you've carried out analysis, etc. So I think we should be doing and focusing on things that work. I think also as psychologists, we have a duty to, I said about sort of knowing our boundaries. Now, I don't mean that in terms of, as I said, I am in favor of, for example, clinical psychologists bringing their knowledge to the coaching session. So I don't mean compartmentalizing ourselves, but boundaries in terms of caveating what we're saying. You know, I'm not an expert in addiction, so obviously I'm not going to help you overcome, you know, your cocaine habit if you had a cocaine habit. So, but does that mean that I couldn't work with someone with a cocaine habit on their productivity levels? I actually think I could work on their productivity levels because that is what I'm an expert in and what my coaching is. But I'd be really clear about what I didn't know.
Yes, there's so much. You see, I've trained quite a lot in polyvagal with Deb Dana, and there's something like five different key models that of which polyvagal is only one. They're all very slightly similar, and I hang out in podcasts where people like Deb Dana come in to bat for their model and Stephen Porges, and I think we always talk about whoever Joe Bloggs is, but if Joe Bloggs on, like, I don't think people really are that interested in the nuances of the different models. So when I say things like, and I did it on the Association for Coaching podcast recently, where I talked about trauma-informed coaching, and I said, I use polyvagal theory it's one of a number of models and it's emerging science. Now, I don't know if that's enough of a caveat for someone to then hang on every word that I said after that. So
I think it's really interesting about how much we know compared to someone else. So as coaches, we are really generalists, I think, because we can work with a variety of clients on a variety of topics. It isn't the case that, you know, we can only coach someone on, you know, I know that you can do things other than trauma-informed coaching. You do leadership, you do other things as well. So we aren't one-trick ponies. Someone who'd have the time to develop the expertise to be a complete expert in whatever topic you want to say, polyvagal theory, like almost by definition wouldn't be a coach because they'd spend all their time doing the academic stuff. Yeah. We're scientists, practitioners. Mm-hmm. So I'm somebody who's a generalist anyway. In a way, before I found coaching, that was the quote unquote problem, that I'd be someone who'd like understand the broad picture, but wouldn't particularly want to go down in too much detail or limit myself to one thing. I'd want to maintain that breadth. And in coaching, I've been able to do that, which I think why it's such a good fit for me personally, but also for lots of people who can see big picture, people who can problem solve, people who can have a good relationship, a motivating relationship with their client. Actually, those are skills rather than sort of knowledge sets. So the times when I'd sort of launch into psychoeducation, where I'm actually explaining a psychological concept, you know, it's not that often in a coaching session where I'd be explaining something in that way. But I would make sure that if I was explaining something, that I definitely knew what I was talking about.
It's interesting, isn't it? Thinking about working with executives or leaders or people in leadership roles and the like huge world that we just opened up there, you know, even the word leadership is not clearly defined, or what leader is, you know, it's open to question and discussion. How strongly do you advocate coaching psychology in that world of leadership? Is it a right place, or should we just leave it to the leadership people?
My sphere of experience is very much in the academic leadership world. So I've developed a niche where I coach academic leaders, which is pretty niche. And academic leaders are navigating, as you know, everyone in a different industry is navigating a particular set of issues. And the academic world, you know, has its own set of issues. And I think it's not just about performance. In fact, it's not really about performance. These are very highly performing people. So a traditional coach and leadership, you know, may well be thinking about, for example, how to position yourself as a leader, you know, how you want to distribute power and responsibility. But these leadership models, and I at this point need to say I'm not a leadership expert, so I definitely need to caveat that. But you know, a lot of these models were developed in the 80s and the 90s. Leadership's changed. It's been developed in corporate settings, but I'm not working in a corporate setting. I'm working in a university setting where everyone's very autonomous and everyone's very opinionated. And so some of those questions that you might help a leader think about it's just not going to be relevant in an academic leadership setting, or you know, you fill in the blank for whatever setting you're working in. So what I think is really important is being adaptable and flexible. So yes, I can read the leadership theories, I can read about leadership coaching, which I of course do, but I have to be super creative and think about how does this apply, if at all, to the situation that's being presented before me. So I don't come in armed with theories and apply them and say you would learn this theory and enact it. Absolutely not. I almost come in with a blank slate, let them tell me what's, you know, going on, and just meet them where they are, which I think all coaches would do anyway. And all organizations have their own culture and their own ways of doing things, so it's not like there's going to be a one size fits all. So I think coaching psychologists can be really creative because, as you said at the beginning, it's such a young field. We can really carve out what it is we're doing. So, as I said, with the clinical psychologists, or maybe a better example for this one is organizational psychologists. I don't have an organizational psychology background, but a lot of my colleagues do. So when they're coming in to coaching psychology, they can draw on that expertise, offer coaching from that background of a real understanding of how a variety of organizations work, and maybe draw on an understanding on a in a practical sense of, you know, they've worked in lots of organizations. I draw on my understanding of knowing how academia works and of having worked in academia, but also my knowledge of leadership and also school leadership, as in high school. So much of it is about thinking in the moment, asking the right question in the moment, relying on yourself to ask the right question. And that's what I think it's all about. I don't think it matters whether we're talking about leadership or, I don't know, personal development or whatever it is. I don't think the topic matters that much. Mm. It might matter in terms of being perceived as someone they can trust, you know. Mm. So if the client thinks you're a credible person because you've been a leader in a similar field, that's more about them feeling comfortable with you. But in terms of you bringing the skills of a coaching psychologist, we're very knowledgeable in both the skills of asking the right questions and all of that, but also the theory. And I think that's the piece for me that makes us psychologists. We can draw on that theory because we've studied it, often at an extremely high level, and not all coaches can.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Like, when I'm talking to organizations, I live in Luxembourg, but I talk to organizations, connect with people around the world via LinkedIn and whatever. And I find it really interesting. It's like, I think there's a general grasp of coaching, and certainly as you alluded to, the performance coaching and what might have been sort of kind of bunny hopped across from the world of sport, you know, like this is goals, this is people working in within structures, within rules, within agreed rules of the game, you know, this kind of thing. And it's like people coaching in leadership circles, stepping from the fact that they were a, you know, captain of a rugby team or leading teams in the SAS or whatever. You know, I think this is really interesting as to where people find their background and their credibility. And then I stand there. So I question myself. I'm like, well, I'm a coaching psychologist and I'm trying to find my own words. Like, well, what does that mean in terms of what they're listening for? Like, how would a coaching psychologist make that difference if I worked alongside an executive team? Worked with them?
Well, it's what you can draw on. So back to the theory, you know, if you had to do a quick Google search of a paper that was seeing how effective a particular type of intervention was, you could quickly Google that, go and look at the abstract, go and have a quick check if it all sounds reasonable, and put that into practice. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't have the skills to quickly read a paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest thing I learned on my PhD is how to amass an enormous amount of information, regurgitate it into something that normal quote unquote, as in non-academic people, can understand. In fact, that is what I was going to say earlier. I had forgotten, but this is what I was going to say, which is that one of the skills of a coaching psychologist, I think, is to, because you were saying when you were challenging me, you were saying, how do we make it into something that a client can understand, like, you know, into a usable, relatable nugget. That's literally our job. How do we take the, you know, scientific studies and papers and knowledge and books and all the rest of it, and in the moment transform it into something that is usable and you know, something that is practical and works? And for me, that almost sums up what a scientist practitioner is, because the scientist practitioner, you've got the science part, which is shortcut for saying understands papers and can read things and read it critically, and then the practitioner is, and put that into practice immediately. So the number of times I'll read a paper, think, oh, that's good, I'll try that, you know, when it next arises, you know. Yeah. I do that a lot.
Yeah. Y'all can't see my eyebrows right now, but I had a big like flash of recognition because I definitely do that. And then I also question myself and I think, am I a one paper reader wonder, you know, that I read a paper on it and now I've tried it out. And, you know, there's this I think that's the frisson, that's the energy of it for me, is where am I not being an expert in it, not trying to claim an expertise, but also confidently standing on definitely a, you know, strong level of knowledge and like those skills that you say to like sift the wheat from the chaff. I'm reading papers thinking, hang on a minute, and you know, flip to the back, who published this? You know, you're really in, like, just critical in that sense of like criticality, are really important. You know, we're wise to what we read. I don't just, people say, oh, my friend's written a book, it's amazing, and I think, I have a quick look at the book and I think, yeah.
No, I don't know if you've ever gone to the GP, and it's a bit disconcerting because sometimes like they Google something while you're there. It's exactly the same point. But actually, if you think about it, you know, if I Googled something, and you see those like shock horror pictures, you know, you put in something very basic and then you see the worst case scenario of it and you think you're dying. Like that's what happens, like, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Quite often. But what the doctor is often doing, they're going through this filtering process. So they're Googling something. They know what they're looking for. They're showing you something. They say, it's not this, it's this, it's like this, it's similar to this. So they are curating that Google search, if you want to put it like that. And actually, I don't need them to remember a whole formulary of whatever formularies do, drugs, I don't know, of stuff. If I'm confident that I know that they know how to get the information. But that part of, do you confidently know how to get information, that is the bit that I'm paying someone for as a psychologist.
Yeah.
Do you know how to find it?
Do you think there's a tension then between digesting it, which I think is, if we were giving it a word, like maybe that might describe it a bit, like you've digested it and in amongst all the things I already eaten, that's fit, it's fitting in, or it's making sense, or my body, my brain is like,
well, that's integration. So it's not attention, it's a natural journey of developing expertise, and it's also how CPD works. So continuous professional development, also a hallmark of course of all coaches and coaching psychologists. So we have to keep learning, you know, either new ideas or deepening existing ones and skills. But in everything, I mean, this is a very existential thing I'm about to say, but in, you know, everything we learn either challenges something that we already know, in which case we have to rethink the original thing, or, you know, deepens something that we already know. But the hard part is not attending a course. Anyone can attend a course and you can amass, as I'm very pleased viewers can't see the state of my office, but you can amass lots of books and papers and handouts and all. Anyone can do that. The hard part is, how do you then integrate that into your practice or not? The answer might be, it's very interesting, thank you, actually that isn't useful for what I do. But that thinking process is a very important part of deciding what you're going to do with that CPD, and having the sort of courage to adopt it as your own in your context, because you get taught a set of skills. As I said, I work in a very niche area. You know, I also support PhD students and having the courage to finish their PhD and the strategies to finish it. And, you know, this is very different to a corporate context. So if I'm going to a training that's largely about corporates, I have to do some proper thinking about how, if at all, it translates to the PhD students who I'm helping. That requires a lot of reflective practice, which you might do in supervision, you might do on your own. You know, there's all different ways of thinking about it. But that itself as an activity, as a coach and psychologist, I have to think about, which is how to integrate or not new stuff I learn.
Oh, love it. You see, it's back to this tension where you said you earlier were talking about the neuroscience thing.
Yeah.
And I think, goodness me, like what a massive topic, the brain. It's like the ocean, isn't it? Half of it's unexplored still. You know, it's what we know and what we don't know, and it's only emerging, and all like that's the science of neuroscience is hotly, like, you know, it's hot. And so when I read a thing, and like, for example, I get stuck into, for example, polyvagal, or what I've learned about how memory is laid down during adverse experiences, which was part of the havening training. And then I talk on a reel or a post or a blog or a whatever, and I'm trying to help someone understand like the headlines. I feel like I'm in danger of diluting it, which is perhaps what you were alluding to with the podcast conversation that you'd had with the neuroscience thing. I'm not sure, but which is what I'm kind of asking you. It's like, are we in danger of diluting it because we have digested it? Like, what's the balance?
Well, again, it's about being clear what you haven't read. So when you do a PhD, for example, and you're writing the literature review, you have to be clear how many papers you've read, what were your search terms, what was included and what was excluded. If I told you I've read 500 papers on existential coaching, you know, you can decide yourself whether you think that makes me someone who knows something about it. Is there going to be someone who's read 1,000 papers? Yes, there is. So I probably don't know as much as them, for sure. Is there going to be someone who's not read any papers? Yes, there is that as well. So there's room for all of us. The person who's read 1,000 papers, I'm not sure they're going to have the time, or it might not be in, you know, in their sort of plans in life to use their knowledge as a coach. The fact that I'm, you know, a very much a practitioner who's using my knowledge probably puts a cap on how, if you're coaching half the day and you're reading half the day, that's not the same as someone who's reading all day, you know. By necessarily you've read less. So I just think it's important to sort of caveat things by saying, this is my interpretation of reading this book or this paper. You know, I can't claim that everybody would read this and come to the same conclusion, but this is what I understand. And I think sometimes we have to make a decision about what we want to know about. So when all the machine learning stuff came out, about Chat GPT, etc., I seriously considered for about 4 minutes going away and doing a master's in, you know, machine learning. This happens quite often, by the way. So I have to. I only allow myself 4 minutes to consider.
I knew we were sisters in some way.
So I have an unhealthy obsession of looking at university websites for courses. So and then I realised, do I have to be the expert in Chat GPT, or can I follow other people who are experts, get the bit I need for what I do? So for using that example, I do help PhD students work out how they can save time by doing things. Now, obviously, they're not allowed to write their PhD with Chat GPT. Yeah. What you can absolutely do is you can put a paper into it, put a journal paper in, and ask for a summary. But again, the summary might be completely wrong. So you've got to have the skills to sort of know. You know, you've got to, like, for example, scan the journal paper yourself, check you know what it means, and then see if the summary is good enough for you as a working summary. But then I wouldn't use that in my work. I would go and rewrite it. But it might well be a basis for something. Yeah. So do I have to do a master's in deep learning to do that, to be able to advise people to use Chat GPT in that way? No. But I have spent quite a few hours just sort of working out who to follow. I think so much of this is, where do you get your information from? You know,
not just have we got information, but where is it from? And curated that
absolutely. So you said, you know, the polyvagal theory stuff, you know, you've got your information from the horse's mouth, as it were. You know, the people who started that, that's where I would get my information from. If I wanted sort of, you know, foundational knowledge, I might read a book by Deb Dana as an example. But then if I wanted to say the next piece, which is, how can I use polyvagal theory in my coaching practice, I would read a book that you had written on the subject, because I don't think necessarily, I don't know if Deb Dana has or hasn't written that. But the point is that it takes someone else often to then apply it to a different context. And that's the piece that I would be missing next.
Oh, super interesting. I am also, because we talked a little bit. This podcast is called Refreshing Leadership for a reason, because I am fascinated about, like, literally the double meaning in refresh. Like, on my phone, I can pull it down and the whole thing refreshes. And I think that's something that I am sensing is happening in the world of leadership, that it's, we are getting a refresh. There's just something exciting is happening. For myself, I see so much in the trauma-informed or neuroaffirmative, or, you know, there's so much then when it, during that refresh, that is jumping into that space. But for you, because you, like, one of the things we didn't talk about at the start was how come you are the chair of the DOCP? And could you talk to me a little bit about what's it like leading that?
When I started my PhD, which was in coaching psychology, there are very few people doing any studies on coaching psychology, because this was something like 2012. Mm-hmm. And there were a handful of studies, of course, but nothing like we have today. Mm. And it was really almost by accident that I was doing coaching psychology. I sort of stumbled across it. I thought it looked interesting. I had a study in mind. I had access to a population that I could study, because so much of this is, you know, you can have an idea for a study, but if you can't access the people you're trying to, then that's the end of that study. So I sort of had the winds blowing favorably, if you like. But for me, I'm someone who's always got my ear to the ground. So I'd signed up for alerts from the BPS. I was already a member of the British Psychological Society. And there was a call for someone to be a student member of the division, a student committee member of the division of it wasn't a division then, of the special group in coaching psychology. And I felt a bit old to be a student, because wasn't 21 exactly. I'd come to this as a second career, because I used to be a teacher and on the senior leadership team. So I was an assistant head teacher of a secondary school and the head of science. So this was a career change. But I thought, okay, well, it sounds interesting, and it's something to do with the realm of my PhD, as in coaching psychology. So I went to some meetings. First of all, I realized I was the same age as other people there, so I didn't feel it was the most welcoming committee and the most well operating committee. That's definitely not the right word, but if you ever needed like a template of how to have a good team meeting, this was it. Mm-hmm. And given that I'd come out of the secondary school and the senior leadership team, I knew what a bad team meeting looked like. And I was like, wow, who are these people? You know, all these people are able to conduct themselves in such a constructive way. And I was there for a couple of years as the student rep. And then actually I got voted on as secretary of the committee. Mm. And then eventually voted as chair of the committee. And I always had not only admiration for my colleagues and, you know, what a lovely group of people. And remember, I was working, you know, as a coach. I was getting my doctorate, so you could say, I guess, as a coaching psychologist, if you want to use the words, in training, although, as we know, it doesn't really mean too much because of the qualification work that you get the qualification at the end, but whatever. And I work on my own because I work for my own business. So being part of a committee meant I actually spoke to other people, mm-hmm. apart from my clients, other professionals. So it gave me really a forum to do other stuff and to meet like-minded colleagues and to really know what was going on at the forefront of coaching psychology. And of course, they thought I knew what was going on at the forefront, because people who are in the throes of their PhDs are very knowledgeable about, you know, the latest research. So they're always valuable people to talk to. And then at one of the conferences, I won the Student Project Award for my PhD work, and I gave a talk about it. And it was soon after that, actually, that I became chair. And one of the things that I did was propose that we had this podcast, because this was the time when everyone had a podcast apart from us. So I said, you know, this is something. And then they said, well, you know, why don't you go and do it then, you know, with their blessing. And that's how I became the podcast host for that. And there were other initiatives as well. So we've all different subcommittees. We now have an outreach, for example, subcommittee, which is where we're helping people consider coaching psychology as a career, particularly people from ethnic minority backgrounds, for example, because it seems at the moment to be quite a white profession. And we're keen to make sure that opportunities are open to all. There's other subcommittees that I've encouraged, for example, lobbying. So we have all these qualifications, but actually the people who procure our services may well not know the difference between a coaching psychologist and a coach, or what does it mean to be chartered versus being a senior practitioner. So there's a certain amount of work that needs to be done just to let the workplace know what do these qualifications mean. But also in the BPS, we are a young division. We only became a division 18 months ago. So even within the BPS, I've done a lot of work with different divisions and member networks so that they know who we are. And indeed, we have so many people who join us from other member networks, like I've mentioned, the clinical and the organisational psychologist, but increasingly lots of people are interested in coaching. It's a very 21st century skill. I mean, if we'd have had this podcast episode, ignore the anachronisms of having a podcast episode 150 years ago, we'd be having this like, oh, everyone's a therapist, you know, everyone's psychologist. But now everyone's a coach, because this is the thing that suits our, you know, 21st century I guess pace of life as well. You know, it's obviously much shorter engagements. The other thing is about really opening out as a division, not making it a top-down thing, like making it a very member-centric vision. And I'm pleased to say we're one of the most, if not the most, I don't want to say the most, because someone will say, oh,
how did you measure that?
Yeah. But you know, people often say that we're really one of the most engaged and engaging divisions, you know, with regular, like very frequent newsletters and CPD. We've got the conference every year, but this year. And we're all about making people feel able to contribute. We've got the peer practice groups. Everyone who's a member should feel that they could submit an abstract for the conference. We have a big push this year on hearing about practitioner experiences, you know, not just people who've in a university doing years and years of research, but what works from the ground up, you know. And that might lead to research later on. Someone will pick it up and say, that's interesting. Why does that work? I'll go and do a 10-year study on it. But first, let's hear what works. So I think that being the chair has, I think first and foremost, has been about empowering some of my, all of the committee to really do what they want to do. You know, this lobbying thing didn't come from me. It came from one of the committee members who said we really need to focus on educating HR managers on what coaching psychologists are. I'm like, great, set up a subcommittee, get some people, let's run with it. And I'm someone who likes to say yes. My first gut instinct is to say yes rather than no. In fact, I, you know, don't think I've ever said no in the context of the committee. So, you know, people have lots of great ideas. It's about, I think, one of the only committees in the BPS who've got a full committee, a full complement of people. You know, people want to be on our committee. You know, they want to contribute. They see it as something that is worth contributing to, worth their time and energy. And an awful lot of time and energy goes into, you know, monthly committee meetings, but the stuff that goes on this round that is enormous. And I think there's this sense of we're building coaching psychology together. It's not a fixed entity. You know, you asked me at the beginning and I thought, gulp, I don't know how to answer it. What is a coaching psychologist? And, you know, I might answer that differently in 10 years' time. And I'm sure someone else now would answer it differently to me. But that's what I like about it. There's room for different voices in a way that some other parts of psychology may feel pretty fixed.
I love that. If I was, we're not coaching now, but I sort of feel it, the parts of me that naturally summarize what someone has said, which will naturally be diluting and skip bits out by my filtering, not yours. But I love that, this concept of building it together. And I wonder if that, because certainly my, as someone who's a member of this organization that you're leading, like that to me is one of the most refreshing things. And I think I've said this to you when we've met in the past, like you're very refreshing in yourself. And I've asked myself, like, what is it about Natalie that is so refreshing? Like, and I wonder if it is you're collaborative to your, you know, to the last drop of your blood. Like, but what would you say is your thing that makes you so refreshing?
Well, it's very nice to hear you think I am refreshing. I think I haven't approached this role, or particularly any role, with a fixed idea of what it means or what it could mean. And I'm very open to seeing how it evolves and, you know, what suggestions come my way. You know, at the end of every newsletter, I say, please email me. And many people email me. People email me after the podcast, after, you know, listening to an episode of the podcast. People are always in conversation with me. And often that leads to, oh, would you like to come on the podcast to discuss? Or if you've got a complaint about the conference, come and organise it next year, which I did say to someone, you know. So if you email me, there's bound to be an action that I make you do afterwards. So beware.
I think I definitely have been one of the yes, emailing you people. But you're so, I think it's, yeah, you're very active. There's a sense that you're listening. That would be another one of my little, what it feels like to me, is that you really are listening. You say email me and then you reply. Like that never happens, right?
Yes, exactly. I do reply.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, I message people on LinkedIn. People message me about, you know, all sorts of things about the chartership. And often it's signposting people to where the information is. And sometimes it's only when people email me that I realize some of the information isn't there. You know, you don't realize what's not there until
it's from the other side.
So that's one of the reasons I welcome people to tell me when there is something they can't find. You know, it's such a basic thing to find the information. So that's an easy win, isn't it, for everyone? I also think that I've never had that thing where you feel like something is your territory. You know, you're very territorial. And, you know, I'm very happy for people to lead on different things and to run with different things. And often all they need is almost like a signing off, you know, it's like a formal, like, yes, you're allowed to do that. And it's about removing obstacles. So you can imagine with a big organization, any big organization, obviously there's layers one has to sign things off, and you know what we do is pretty public facing, so we've got to be really careful about what we do. But I'll attend to that. If you tell me you want to run with this project, I'll deal with the BPS signing off, legalities, formalities, so that you can go and do the stuff that's, you know, not going to swamp you. I see that as my role, to remove those sort of administrative and it's not only administrative, sometimes it's more like negotiation with the powers that be. Just to give you an example, one of my other roles at the BPS, I am the chair, as you know, but what you don't know is that I'm also something called chair of Senate, which is an internal role, which is I'm a member of the board of trustees, and I'm sort of like the chair of the chairs. So that all the different chairs, we have three or so meetings a year, plus, you know, people can talk to me whenever about, you know, any concerns or ideas or projects they want to get off the ground. And, you know, it might be sort of cross-divisional, like things like DEI, as an example, or things like this. And people come to me and then I represent their division, their voice on the board of trustees. So in this role, as an example, there's a group that's been trying to get off the ground for years, trying to get a member network around environmental psychology. And I had to get to the bottom of why had it not happened for years. There was obviously something that was... It turned out there wasn't really a reason. It was a bit inexplicable what was going on. And I challenged it, you know, from a process point of view. I don't understand what was the blockage. And now I'm pleased to say that, you know, this is going ahead and it's all sort of working out. So I see my role there. You know, it's not like I had the idea of setting up environmental psychology. It's not my idea. But somehow I was the one who unblocked it by finding out I was the plumber.
Well, there's many systems related metaphors and allegories that really work in coaching. And I love it. So yeah, you remove obstacles, you're open to evolution, you're part of the evolution, you're like in it, not outside it. And you are collaborative, and you're a permissioner. You say yes, but you enable, but you don't just say yes and don't follow it up. You're quite
A connector.
Oh yeah, my friend calls herself a connectivator, which I think is quite a cool thing. I think you're probably one of those as well. Yes, but something switching to dog metaphors, like a dog that won't let go. You do see things through. There's something like that. I think like if we were writing a little thing about your leadership qualities, like not necessarily just you, but then going, are these relevant, refreshing leadership qualities? Like one of the things I'm always asking people on this podcast is, you know, what is it? And because it's all very well, because we all kind of have our own idea about what a refreshing leader is, but like, what is it? And I think you've just given these lovely, really clear examples of just exactly how that is showing up for you. And would I say it's just you and just in the context you're in? No, I can really hear how this is. It's inspiring for me to listen. I hope it's inspiring for people listening to us talk now.
Yes. So the positive way of saying a dog that doesn't.
Oh, yes, let, yes. Go on. You reframe it.
Tenacious.
Yeah.
No, that's true. I think something that frustrates me is when you go to meetings, and I do go to a lot of board meetings and committee meetings, as you can hear. And sometimes you get the sense of you're saying something and then it's just going down a black hole and no one's doing anything about it. And I follow up, and I often say to people, I mean, this is good practice, obviously, for any meeting, but, you know, who is taking this action away? And do they know that? Because sometimes I think people get allocated actions and they don't actually know it was them who's been allocated. So I think it's really important I think maybe people find that a bit annoying about me, to be honest, that I will just then say, that's a great idea, but who is the person who's following that up and will report back? Mm. And I'm the one pinning it down rather than sort of going to the ether. But I know what happens otherwise, it just disappears. And I think that's the pragmatic part of me again. One does need to pin it down, and must be a bit exhausting, I imagine, being in a meeting with me, because I'm always like making people take things on.
I don't know. If I ever am one day, I'll let you know. Oh, I just look, we're drawing to the end of our time together. I am so grateful for you to come. This is every bit as fun and exciting and edgy a conversation as I had hoped for. And I was just thinking there, like, this is so cool. This is exactly what you just described, is that you get a member saying, would you come on my podcast? And you said yes. And then you arrived on the call before we start and you're like, 2 seconds, Kate, what are we doing here? You know, you're just so yes-y about it. And I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much for your time. Would you like to finish by just, because you're telling people where they find you and all that kind of stuff?
Sure. You're very welcome to find me on LinkedIn. So I'm under Dr. Natalie Lancer, or look at my website, www.natalielancer.com.
Oh, that's so cool. And I'll put it in the show notes and all the normal thing. And thank you so much. Well, I look forward to seeing you at conference this year. It's going to be cool.
Yeah.
See you then. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode. While I'm here, did you know that I work one-to-one with people who are ready to make change for the better for themselves or others? And can I make a plea for our leaders who are especially under pressure, not only to balance their own mental health, but leading balanced and thriving teams? The fallout of the pandemic and the increasing economic pressures have made this a really grey area for mental health worldwide. And the burden is falling on our leaders and managers. If you'd like to ease suffering and get the fun back, rebuilding resilience and lasting mental health in yourself or your team, remember that healthy financial results and great business performance can only come from high-performing people who are in top condition to thrive. Let me help you help your people. Now, get in touch and let's start the conversation.